You're listening to How To 20-Something, the only podcast that helps both men and women navigate their 20s and learn how to adult across all aspects of their lives. We're going to be focusing on career, relationships, finances, fitness, nutrition, and all of the common challenges and obstacles a typical 20-something will face in this post-college life and what to do about it. I'm your host, Jess Diamond, and I am the CEO and founder of Jess Diamond Coaching, where I help young professionals get their shit together, gain their confidence, and own their life. No one prepares you for this adulting world, so allow me to help you feel like you are no longer a chicken running around with its head cut off, and that you actually know what the hell is going on and what your next step to take is. Welcome to How To 20-Something. Welcome back to another episode of How To 20-Something. Today, I've brought on a guest to highlight some of the common mishaps or even traps people fall into when it comes to their weight loss or fat loss journey. I do want to begin by saying anyone who is listening to this should know that we're going to talk about this and it's not the end-all be-all because it's always going to depend. It'll depend on the individual, on what you've been doing previously, on your genetics, on your goals, on your lifestyle, and so many other factors. But even knowing that, Kyle and I are in the fitness and nutrition space, and we see a lot of bad information out there or thought processes that trip people up. So we're here to set the record straight when it comes to your fitness regimen, your nutrition, your overall health, and the focus of your goals to help you with that fat loss or weight loss that you are seeking. And actually, before I introduce Kyle to the show, I want to remind you guys about my upcoming video call about the top 5 confidence-killing fears and what to do about them. So if you're listening to this in real time or before 7:30 p.m. Eastern on Monday, April 29th, then you still have time to sign up and receive the Zoom link and the replay. But this is for you if you don't want to turn 80 and reflect back on your life and feel regret about the dreams you were too afraid to chase after. It's completely free, and you can head to justdiamondcoaching.com/fear or check the show notes for that link to join me and a bunch of other young adults who also don't want to let their fear hold them back from living their life to its fullest. So, go sign up, and while you do that, you can listen to me tell you a little bit about Kyle Markle. Kyle is a strength and nutrition coach. His background is in psychiatric nursing, and he began coaching about 3 years ago after obtaining his ACE Health Coach certification. Kyle works predominantly with strength athletes and combat sports athletes. His nutrition coaching style is focused on behavioral and lifestyle changes in order to set clients up for long-term success. As a coach, he has worked with athletes placing top 10 at Arnold Amateurs and Strongman Nationals, and has also worked with pro MMA fighters and BJJ, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu athletes. Hi, Kyle. Welcome to How To 20-Something.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be on.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on, and I just want to get right into it and hear what you have to say. So we're going to start with the gym, and I just want to say, if someone comes to you and is like, Kyle, I want to lose fat, what is the first thing I should make sure I'm doing when it comes to my fitness regimen?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, I think there's kind of two sides to that. I think like the textbook answer for me, like a general answer would be, hey, we really want to focus on getting that strength training in probably 3 to 4 days a week. But, you know, I think there is a little variance too, as far as what does the person enjoy to do? What can we find that balance of? And you know, finding that middle ground. And, you know, I am in the camp that there should be some cardiovascular component, but I think that too many people rely on that too heavily and make that the bulk of their programming versus I like to focus on, hey, let's get the strength training component in and then intertwine some zone 2 cardio throughout the week to really just more from a health standpoint than from anything else. And so, yeah, it's hard to answer sometimes directly because there's just so many different factors. And I love that in the intro, you put the little disclaimer of the it depends, because on my podcast, my buddy Sean and I, it's like every answer is always, well, it really depends. But in general, yeah, so it's, you know, having that base of that strength training. And I think too, with that being said, so many times people want to go complete to the extreme end of the spectrum and think that working out 7 days a week is going to help them hit their goals the most. And I won't go too far down that rabbit hole with hormone profiles and all of that with overtraining, but you know, I find most people, if we can get them, 3 is kind of that sweet spot. 2 is definitely great. 4 is definitely great. We can kind of find that middle ground. But that somewhere between that 3 to 4, 2 to 4 days per week strength training, really making that the meat and potatoes of our programming, for lack of a better term. And then, you know, how do we throw in other things that you enjoy, whether it's like hiking or long bike rides, stuff like that, to get some of the cardiovascular component, but really building that emphasis around the strength training component.
Yeah, I agree. I personally do 3 days a week strength training. And then, I mean, I do a lot of walking with my job as a personal trainer. So I get my steps in, and then I play sports, pick up sports on the weekends. So that's where I get my cardio in, because I'm not someone that just will go for a run. I don't love group fitness classes, but I'll do them every now and then. But it's really the strength training is my love. I feel like it's the most mental clarity, and then it has the aesthetics that accompany it, which is what this episode is centered around.
Yep, 1,000%.
When you break down this 2, 3, or 4 days a week, what would that look like on, let's say, like if someone says they can only commit to 2 days, or someone says they can only commit to 3 days, or someone says they can only commit to 4, how is that going to change your process of working with them based off of their level of commitment to doing a specific fitness regimen?
Yeah, absolutely. So I usually like to start those calls with, how many days a week do you want to work out? And then I usually subtract a number off of that. And so a lot of times with my clients, what I like to do is, so if they say, hey, I want to do 5 days, I might say, all right, we're going to do 3 base days, calling them foundational days or something like that, where we're doing the bulk of our training. And then I'll throw in supplemental days on top of that. So I really like to build that structure that if they have extra time, they want to go to the gym, or they really want to go to the gym, great, we can do that. Some of those supplemental days, we can focus on mobility work, or hey, that's where we do some zone 2 cardio work, or hey, that's where we do some fluff and buff on some extra body parts you want to emphasize. But really, in general, building that base program. And then for me, if it's in the 2-day category, we're pretty much always going to do a full body split, really top to bottom, working on compound movements from there. 3 to 4 days, we can play with it a little bit more. And this is where it's also, you know, really dependent on, hey, are they, you know, a power lifter? We might be able to build a program differently than a strongman athlete versus just a general population person. And so I think in general, two days, definitely full body. 3 days, I'm either full body, or a lot of times I'll do an upper day, a lower day, and a full body day. 4 days a week, I generally do an upper day, lower day, upper day, lower day. But I really like to shift that focus really behind the scenes from a programming standpoint to focus on a movement for the day versus necessarily muscle groups. Now, muscle groups are a component of that, but I really like to break it down. Like, we'll do a 4-day a week split for an example. I'll have a squat day, a bench day, deadlift day, and overhead press day, really building on those foundational 4 movements. And then I try to build the rest of the program off of the day based on that. So for example, if we're doing a 4-day split with this example, if we have a squat day, day 1, I like to have some sort of hinging pattern on the second movement. So I really try to focus my programs on, hey, we're going to have a primary mover, a supplemental exercise to assist that mover that's kind of an opposite movement pattern, and then 3 to 4 accessory exercises on focused muscle groups depending on where the deficiencies are. So, you know, squat will follow it with a hinge, deadlift day will follow it with a squat, bench day and overhead press day will follow it with some sort of back focused movement on that. And so that's really how I build the framework of that. But I try not to get too wrapped up in, I know in the aesthetics world, a lot of the focus is on how many, you know, sets per week of muscle group. And I think that's really great if that's your focus. I personally don't have any clients that are like 110% focused on, you know, bodybuilding or aesthetics. It's really a performance space. And that's a whole other conversation of focusing on performance. But, you know, with that, it's really going to be, like I said, those movement pattern days, and how do we break it down and spreading that out throughout the week, and how do we really focus on increasing those main 4 lifts and building from there?
Yeah, I agree, which I love when I bring on a guest. I'll mention this again later, but Kyle and I connected through a fitness forum that we're both in. So we both follow the same fitness guys that have their own podcast. I've mentioned them several times on this podcast already. And I think we both have learned a lot from their philosophies and their programming and have applied it to our clients and even ourselves. So I do the same thing of, we have one main lift and then accessory things to either complement that lift, or if it's a full body day, it's like you have the main one and then accessory to the other parts of your body, so you're not leaving the gym feeling like, oh, I only worked out one muscle group. Most of my clients are on a 2 times a week or 3 times. I even have some that are on 1 times. I'm like, let's just get you in the gym. And that's what we do. I call it, I was like, we do upper front, upper back, lower front, lower back is the way I explain it to them. So I was like, just so you feel like you're hitting every body part to some extent. It doesn't have to be these extreme compound lifts every single time, although a majority of them do end up that way, because I feel in a 45-minute session, that's how you get the most bang for your buck. So how can someone who's listening determine what modality is going to be the best towards their fat loss goals? But before you answer that, I want to reiterate that you had said of, one, it's going to depend. That's going to be our answer throughout the whole episode. But two, it's also, what do you enjoy doing? So those two things aside, just, I want to lose fat. What is the best thing I can do for myself? And then also, what would be the worst thing I could do for these goals?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm really big from a coaching standpoint on, I don't like to make our exercise choices focused on that goal of weight gain or weight loss. And so I really, from a behavioral change focus standpoint, body image, all those different things, I really like to drive our exercise to be performance-based and focusing on a performance goal, and then really addressing the fat loss or muscle gain or whatever that looks like for somebody on the nutrition side of things. So I really try to avoid using like the terminology and the conversation being like, okay, we're going to do this exercise for fat loss. So I try to scrap that from their minds and say, from a physical performance standpoint, what would our goal be for this? And, you know, that can be, hey, obtaining muscle size, that can be getting stronger, that can be moving better, that can be, hey, I want to be able to perform better at my weekend pickup basketball games, that can be, I want to jump higher, like whatever that focus is. I really try to push them to like, let's make a lifting specific, training specific goal that we can attain. And then, hey, let's address the fat loss and whatever other nutritional goals are just on the nutrition side of things. Like, there certainly is a carryover, but I think it's like a hamster wheel race if you're trying to work off the body fat and if you're trying to make your exercise focused on how can I burn as much as possible to lose weight. And so, you know, with all those performance goals in mind, the background there and the intention is going to be getting better performance, stronger, faster, more mobile, all those different things. Building muscle is going to be the result of all of those factors, which as a result in the long run will help us increase our metabolism, lose fat faster, all those different things. So I do really try to like differentiate that with people. And I know it's a question that like we get as coaches and trainers all the time of like, what's the best workout for fat loss? And so it is a big mindset shift trying to convince people of like, let's not address that in the gym. Let's just work on feeling better, moving better, performing better, and we'll work on fat loss outside of that. But yeah, I think the easy general answer is, hey, let's focus on getting stronger. That's a really easy one to just focus on. It's really measurable. I think that's more attainable. Like if you don't have the base of strength, I think it's harder to focus on the other goals of like jumping higher, running faster, moving better, all those different things. You have to have that base level strength first. And that's a really general tip. And it's really easy to see progress. And it gets a lot of buy-in from people really early on. Like there's nothing better as a coach seeing someone who's pretty new to lifting and having them put like 150 pounds on their squat in a year, just because they're improving so much with all the CNS development, all those different things. So I hope that answers that question. But yeah, that's kind of my thoughts there.
It does. Can we build off of an essence of what you were saying? Basically, you don't need to hammer yourself in the gym to see results. Can you just elaborate on that mentality? Because I hear that come up so many times of, oh, I need to be depleted. I need to walk out of the gym absolutely drenched in sweat. And if I didn't, it wasn't a good workout. It wasn't effective. And we're here to debunk those things. So I would love your two cents on that matter.
Yeah, it's a really big misconception, especially among like the general population, focusing on that component of like, I'm going to beat myself up in the gym. And I think, you know, this is where some of my psychiatric nursing background comes into it, and the body image issues around this with exercise. And it's, you know, a lot of times it comes from a place of they hate their body, they hate themselves. So they almost want to punish themselves in the gym in a sense to make themselves feel better. Like, and really just shifting that mindset into like, hey, let's be positive about ourselves. And we want to focus on this improvement pattern. We want to focus on getting better, getting stronger, all these different things. And I will tell you, I see all the time people coming to me and I look at their program or I look at what they've done in the past and they're definitely overtraining. And I think sometimes that's a term that gets thrown around a little too much. Like I think there's the other end of the spectrum that people are like, well, I don't want to overtrain, so I'm only going to lift like 20 minutes once a week. And like there's a balance there to that. But I've had so many clients where we go through this phase and we actually decrease what their exercise looks like and we increase their calories. and they're sitting there and they lose weight. And then it's like, well, this doesn't make any sense because, yeah, like if you look at it from that perception, it's like, yeah, that doesn't make a ton of sense, right? But this kind of dives down the rabbit hole too without going too off track of the whole calories in, calories out conversation. And I'll tie it back in at the end, I promise. But so bear with me, everyone. But the calories in, calories out, that is, you know, that's a law of physics. There's nothing we can do to change that. This is how the human body works. But what we can manipulate is what the calories out portion of the equation actually looks like. And so that's where it's like there's this balance. And you'll hear me talk about that all the time, like balance in the middle, because there's so many extremes and things. But there is a balance, the calories in, calories out equation, and we need to figure out the best way to manipulate the calories out portion of the equation. And so one of those main things is when we are consistently overtraining, we're going to have an increase in cortisol, the stress hormone. So when we increase cortisol, that's going to cause us to have more water retention, general weight retention as a whole. Our performance isn't going to be great. We're not going to sleep well. We're going to be stressed all the time. And so when our cortisol is high, it has this inverse relationship with testosterone, which is going to be our, you know, muscle building hormone. And so when our cortisol is really high, we're putting ourselves in a position where we can't really build muscle and burn body fat because of the hormone profile as a result of the high cortisol. So that's a long-winded answer in a way to just say that, hey, when we are really overtraining and beating the crap out of ourselves, we can't recover from it. And if you're one of my athletes listening to this, like you've heard me talk about this all the time, like recovery is such a big component of everything we're doing, whether it's aesthetics, performance, health, like we have to be able to recover from what we're doing. And so you see exactly that. You see so many people just go into Orange Theory, like no shots at Orange Theory necessarily, but they go to Orange Theory 7 days a week and they're like, I can't lose weight and I'm barely eating any calories. And it's like, well, yeah, because your cortisol is through the roof. You're not able to recover from what you're actually doing. And it can be really hard sometimes to get people to buy into that. And there is a whole component of that from a coaching standpoint, like how do we get people to buy into this process of, you know, we need to cut back on exercise in order to actually lose weight. And so, you know, this happened to me really recently with a client where he was way overtraining. We were having those conversations. He went on vacation, wasn't training for a couple of weeks, ate God knows what, because we gave him a little break from tracking, but definitely over what his normal was. And he actually came back a little lighter. And it was like, what the hell happened? I was like, well, there you go. That's a perfect proof that you were overtraining. You just, your body needed time to recover. And, you know, if you're not recovered and you're not able to get into that parasympathetic state, you're not going to make progress regardless of what your goal is. And it goes both ends of the spectrum too. I have a lot of clients that I have a handful of super heavyweight strongmen that are trying to gain weight. And I know that's probably like a really foreign concept to a lot of people listening of like, yeah, these guys are trying to go from 290 to 320, but it's the same concept. If they're not in a healthy state, if they're not in a state to be able to build muscle or put on body tissue as a whole, they're not going to be able to. So a lot of times we have to tone back that training. And so I'm really big on, I forget how Adam phrases it on Mind Pump, but like getting the most out of the least, basically, but really big on that of like, you know, we can make progress on the 2 to 3 days a week, cutting back your volume, cutting back your intensity, whether that's, you know, percentage of a one rep max, volume, all those different factors, and really just seeing what the results are from that. And it is a big shift for a lot of people, and it can be hard to make that trust in a coach of like being able and being willing to do this. But I think one of the cool things is unless you're in a seriously overtrained state, which most people aren't in that like severe overtrained state where they're borderline rhabdo, but unless you're in that state, those results come pretty fast from cutting back your workouts. Now there are granted some asterisk there of some people might take a little longer, but a lot of people see that in a few weeks if they cut back some of the intensity and increase their calories, actually fuel their body, and they actually lose some weight.
Wow. So you mentioned a lot of what I wanted to talk about. So this is great. Yeah. I want to say the phrase that Adam says, so Adam is from Mind Pump. Mind Pump is the podcast that I talk about all the time, is it doing the least amount of work to elicit the most amount of
there
change.
There it is. Yep.
That's the one. And then you started to talk about the calories in versus calories out and changing the back half of that equation of the calories out. But you and I both know, and as you were explaining afterwards, that it's not that simple. And I think where a lot of people getting started or using fitness apps or tracking apps or anything of that sort start to include the calories that their watch says they burned or some unit of measurement that says that they burned during their workout, and they plug it into that app for their overall calorie intake for the day. Why shouldn't someone do that?
Yeah, so I'm just going to very straight up and transparent. It's horrible. Like the error percentages on those are very, very bad. And there's so many reasons as to why, because the human body is not a formula. It's not a math number. So, you know, somebody at my exact same height and weight is going to have a totally different caloric burn during the exact same workout, just depending on, hey, what's my work capacity versus their work capacity? what's my lean body mass versus their lean body mass. There's so many factors that play a role. So they use these formulas, but I think the error rate on those devices is upwards of like 40% error rate. So they're really inaccurate. And so I pretty much tell everyone, like, we're not even going to address that. Like, it's cool if you want to look at it and be like, yeah, I burned 1,000 calories. Reality is you probably didn't. And it's even worse on the gym machines. So like outside of the wearable, like the actual gym machines themselves, the error rates are really high, like 50% upwards sometimes. But in general, the accuracy of those are just so poor. So we don't even look at that as far as what our caloric equation actually looks like. And there's only so much that you can actually burn during exercise. Now, granted, sure, there is, you know, a high level of calorie burn. And let's say like my jiu-jitsu athletes or MMA guys that are training really intense. But for most people, that's not going to be super applicable. And even with those, we're not even using those numbers because, once again, just how inaccurate they are. And the difference between getting your metabolism at a high enough number maintenance-wise that we can lose weight from versus what you can burn off in an exercise portion is like two very important conversations to have of just, you know, it's way, way better and strategically better to increase what our maintenance metabolism actually looks like and put ourselves in a position where, you know, we can lose weight on a lot higher calories versus trying to burn off that donut you ate at your morning meeting in the office. And so that's a hard game of catch up to play, you know, constantly trying to match that. But once again, the science of learning how to burn a calorie and actually tracking that is super in depth that a watch just can't replicate at all.
Yeah. I mean, even a human can't really replicate it. Like, we don't know. There's so much that we don't know about our metabolism and our calories and what's actually going on. So it's, I think, like, at the end of the day, is when you're including your workout into your overall caloric intake, as in you're subtracting those calories that you quote unquote burned, you're not doing right math, because there is no way to actually fully accurately calculate that kind of math. So you don't include it and just focus on the food, because you do know what's in your food because you're eating whole foods, because don't even get us started on nutrition labels of how inaccurate those are, because those have a 20% inaccuracy rate behind them. So it's the whole foods, it's weighing and measuring those things out. Yes, it's tedious, but that's what's going to give you that clear picture of what it is that you're actually bringing into your body, so then we can figure out how we can manipulate your movement outside of that, or your nutritional intake outside of that as well. So it's getting that clear picture, that maintenance, that where you're currently at, to be able to take the step in the direction that you want to go.
Yeah, and that goes exactly back to the point too that I was saying earlier. I don't use exercise as the modality of focus for weight loss, and that's the exact one of the exact reasons why, is just we can't track what that actually looks like, and there's no way to do it. And so really emphasizing that component of that separation there when it comes to weight loss.
Yeah. I had a bodybuilder, like a pro bodybuilder, come on a couple weeks ago, and she mentioned a really important statistic of your body, like your goals, everything is 70% of that comes from your nutrition. That's a giant bulk. And I would even argue it's probably closer to 75 to 80% of that is your nutrition. So she went on the low end of that spectrum.
Yeah, that's going to be the big focus. It's an old phrase and it gets overused sometimes, but you really can't outwork a really poor diet. And, you know, we can do the best to mitigate the risks of a really poor diet, right? And like, if you have muscle mass and you're working out and you're exercising, those things are going to help mitigate the risks of having a really poor diet and being really overweight. But it's not going to, you can't overwork the poor diet component of things. If you don't have your nutrition at least relatively in the right direction, you're not going to make the progress that you want to make.
Yeah, which we're going to switch into nutrition. So I want to just start this episode with fitness, because I think a lot of people, that's the first thing they go to, is I want to lose some fat or I want to lose some weight. I'm going to go work it off. And so we've covered that topic. Now let's go into really what matters, and that is your nutrition. I personally like to focus on the things that we can add to this meal or to the snack to make it better, instead of going to the mentality of I need to remove certain food groups. But I also know that the first thing people like to do outside of their increasing their cardio, which we just told you don't do that, is cut out carbs. They like to cut out a food group, cut out something. They're like, I can't have this anymore. And they go into this full restrict mode. Can you talk about what's actually happening when you cut out a food group, and maybe why you don't actually need to?
Yeah. It's a really hot topic. And this is something that kind of shifts all the time in social media, whether it's fat, carbs, or now some people are saying protein, et cetera, cutting out food groups. And, you know, at the end of the day, cutting out those food groups, does it work? Yeah. But I think the reason that cutting out food groups works is just so poorly explained. And goes back to the conversation of the calories in, calories out. So yeah, if you cut out carbohydrates and you're only eating protein, and especially if you're eating like healthier fats, like it's a really easy way to control calories because you're going to be really satiated, all those different things. But you're taking away your ability to perform super well in the gym by taking away carbohydrates. And so cutting out the food groups, sure, it works from a actual like science standpoint, if we're going to call it that, just because you're limiting calories. But please don't buy into all the nonsense. And I'll try to spare you my hour-long rant on keto stuff and all of that. But kind of a tangent with that, it's the same thing with people that go carnivore for a certain amount of time and they proclaim all the great health benefits of carnivore and how it freed up all their allergies and all these different, you know, intolerances they have with food. And it's like, yeah, that going carnivore did that, but it's not because you're only eating meat. It happened because you eliminated something that was probably affecting you negatively. And so really the end game is just how do we get ourselves on a caloric deficit? And there's 100 ways to do that. There's a bunch of ways to go about it. But at the end of the day, we got to find what actually works for you. And that's my big issue with cutting out the food groups, is that most times I see that people come to me after they've done something like that, they've almost always completely fallen off the wagon, for lack of a better way to say it. And they put on a bunch of weight, including more than they started at a lot of times, because we're really feeding into that restrict binge model. And I try to tread carefully about like eating disorders versus disordered eating. But I do think that most Americans have disordered eating patterns. And one of the biggest ones being that restrict and binge model. And, you know, I see that a ton, especially working with weight class athletes, having that balance. And so all you're doing when you do this restricting a certain food group, you're just further feeding into this restrict binge model, that when eventually it's pretty much like 101, you're going to restrict this for so long, eventually you're going to crave it, and then you're going to go way, way, way overboard with it. And then it's not like, that's not an anomaly. That happens almost all the time when people do that. Now, sure, there's some people that are able to cut out carbs and do great for a really long time, and that's awesome for them. But you know, when it comes to different diets, different protocols you see on the internet, it's like, you got to find one that works for you that you can actually do forever. And I would say 90% of people, it's not going to work by restricting a certain food group. And so I think it's more just about, I'm really focused on, let's have an educational session about, you know, why certain food groups actually matter. And, you know, I'm really careful not to use terminology of like bad food versus good food. And that's a conversation with like the whole processed food debate about, you know, bad versus good. And I really try to steer away from that. You know, every food has nutritional value. It's just, how do we apply that nutritional value to what our goals are right now? And, you know, it's almost, a lot of clients describe it, it's almost like a freeing experience when they work with a coach who's like, yeah, you can eat carbs. Like, it's okay to have a slice of pizza on a Friday night. Just don't have three Domino's XL pizzas on a Friday night. Like, there's a balance to it. And so, yeah, I know I got kind of sidetracked there, but yeah, it's, you know, it can be a losing battle for most people if you're really focusing on just cutting out a single food group. Like, we need all those different macro and micronutrients to be a healthy individual. And so it's just a losing battle trying to do that.
Yeah, so I agree. I'm so glad you mentioned all of that, because it is, at the end of the day, if you're cutting out a food group, what you're really doing is you are decreasing your calories. That's what's happening. But what you're also doing when you go that route is you're going into that restrict mode. And I call it your inner child is rebelling. Like, you are rebelling against yourself. You are telling yourself, you can't have that, you can't have that. And what happens when you tell a child they can't have or they can't do something? All they're going to want to do is go and do what they can't do or have what they can't have. So that's what you're doing to yourself, is you're taunting yourself. You're like dangling candy in front of you of like, nope, you can't have it. And all you're going to do is hyper focus on it and think about it until finally your mental discipline gives out, because it will. And then you go in the complete opposite direction. You go all in because you either feel like, oh, I've deprived myself for so long, I deserve it, I've earned it, or you just have the extreme craving for it. So you have no balance that has come with it. You're not able to separate your hunger needs, your hunger cues, with what's in front of you.
Yeah, 1,000%. I couldn't have said it better. I like the inner child analogy. And you know, like you said, willpower. And I try to emphasize to clients, like, unless you're David Goggins, willpower is only going to get you so far. Like, yeah, it's a good skill to work on, right? To an extent, from like resiliency and all those different things. I don't want to neglect that, but willpower doesn't work forever. And what ends up happening is exactly that. You know, there are no carb until they go out on a Friday night, they have a couple of drinks. They're like, well, I can have a couple carbs. And then the entire weekend is just like 700 grams of carbs a day and pasta and pizza, because it's just basic human psychology at that point, and it does not work for people pretty consistently. And so I really discourage people from that. And, you know, like we've mentioned a million times, it's about finding that balance of having the foods you enjoy. And really and all the data supports this too, not even just like coaches talking about it, but when you allow yourself to have those foods that you enjoy and just practicing moderation with it, you're going to be really successful long term. And it's just such a big behavioral shift. And like I said, I get that all the time when I start with new clients and they're just like stoked that they get to eat the foods they really like. And it's like, yeah, it's, you know, we can have those in moderation here and there, and it's not going to cause you to go off the deep end compared to, you know, completely restricting carbohydrates and having that binge every other weekend. So.
Yeah, I think another way I help my clients look at it is I don't really say anything that they can't have. I know you mentioned like you don't say whether a food is good or bad. I also say food doesn't have a moral compass. So it's the same phrase. But what I do is I'll shift their focus to, hey, let's make sure we're hitting our protein targets. And we're getting it from Whole Foods. Like, let's make sure we're doing that. Are we doing that? Okay, great. Then if you also happen to have a donut, that's fine. But then what we also do is focus on how you're feeling. Did that donut make you feel great? Did it allow you to make better choices after? Did it give you energy to go carry on with the rest of your day? Or did you get a tummy ache and you had to go to the bathroom?
Yeah.
Like, be real with yourself. It's the food, just because a food is, yes, if it's processed versus not processed, obviously a whole food is going to be a better option, but it doesn't mean you can never have a piece of cake or a donut or pizza or ice cream. Like, it's, you can still have those foods. It's just knowing how much of those foods are actually going to be conducive to your goals, as well as to how you're feeling that day and how you want to be feeling about yourself.
Yeah, 1,000%. And one of my favorite tips I like to give people is like, hey, if there's a certain food that you really want to have, and, you know, once again, we want to avoid that kind of restrict binge, like, go ahead and have that food. But a really simple tip would be, hey, let's have, you know, 30 to 50 grams of protein, depending on the size of the person, before you go and have that. Like, if you're going to have 30 grams of protein in a glass of water, that is just naturally going to cut down your intake of the actual food you're having anyway. So it's like, hey, if you've checked all the boxes, you've done all the right things, like, absolutely have that cookie, 110%, go for it. Just do the right things first, and you're setting yourself up for success with that later by having some of those little tips just throughout the day, you know, making sure you're hitting your protein, having that snack of protein before you go and have that food. And I think it's the same principle I like to encourage clients to do before they're going out to dinner, for example. And, you know, make sure you've had a lot enough of your protein for the day, so then you can go and enjoy that pasta dish and a glass of wine without going crazy over your calories or crazy indulgent during that meal because you starved all day because you're going to the best Italian restaurant in town. And sure, that might be fine every once in a while, but if that's every Saturday, you're never going to hit the end goal that we're looking for.
Yeah, exactly. And so another portion of nutrition that I want to touch on is, it actually came up from one of the responses. So I posted the topic of this episode in the same fitness forum that Kyle and I are both in, and just to see what some of the responses would be, because a lot of these people have been on their own journeys or they're in the space for one reason or another. And a woman commented saying how expensive it is to eat healthy. And I personally disagree with her, because if you plan your meals or different types of meals around similar foods and just change up the sauces, you really don't need to be buying that much. I know I live alone. My grocery bill is not that high, and I eat almost all of my meals at home. I hardly ever eat out. So while, yes, technically, a McDonald's hamburger is going to be cheaper than the one you can get at a supermarket, but I think that's thinking more in the short term. So it's kind of that saying of save money on food now and pay your health bill later, or spend a little bit more now and not have to pay your hospital bill later. But all of that being said, what are your thoughts when people say, oh, it's cheaper to eat out than to stay in and cook, or it's easier to eat out than to stay in and cook?
Yeah, I think that's two different conversations. I think the price one first, I personally find that hard to believe that anybody can actually back up that claim. I don't know. I don't get fast food a ton, but like recently it was in a pinch. It was super late at night. I was like, the only thing open is McDonald's and I need food. So I went to McDonald's and it was like $15 for like a burger and fries and a drink. And I was just like, I don't know how people can argue that. I mean, I know there's the value menus and all that stuff, but I don't know. Every time I go out to eat, I'm spending way, way more than I would at home. And I will also add the caveat of like, I live in Morgantown, West Virginia, so cost of living is super cheap here. So my conversation might not relate to everyone. But, you know, I think in general, a lot of times that conversation comes around from the idea that people think they need to buy like only organic or grass-fed or cage-free eggs and all these different things. And it's, I think if you have the money to spend on those things, great. But I don't think there's enough strong data to support there that says you have to do that. And I would much rather not buy those things and just make generally healthy choices in the grocery store. I just have a hard time seeing that argument. I haven't really found somebody to be able to really back that up if they're comparing their eating out bill for a week versus their grocery shopping bill for a week, unless they're doing like, oh, well, I can only buy grass-fed steak. I can only buy organic fruits and vegetables. Because I'm agreeing with you, my grocery bill, I mean, my grocery bill is probably higher than average because I eat a lot of food. But I think in general, it's really not, you know, if you're really just focusing on getting meat, carbohydrate, fruits and vegetables, I just don't see how it is really that expensive. Now, the ease of, you know, cooking versus eating out, I understand that conversation. I think that's more of a like, hey, I think there's a good point there and I think we can have a conversation around it. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, it is absolutely easier to pick up food versus cooking your own food. But I think there's a big caveat with that of like, okay, what does your cooking food process actually look like? And this is a big conversation I have with my clients because, you know, especially for my realm, a lot of my, you know, competitor athletes that are really focused on competition, they're in the gym a lot. They spend, I don't know if you've ever seen a strongman workout or anything, but it takes a lot of time to set up and break down. And it can be a pain in the ass sometimes, but we love it. But it is a lot of time in the gym. And, you know, if you're working a full-time job, it can be hard. And so I really emphasize like, how can we make the cooking process as simple as possible? And I always tell clients, you know, there's a million food meal prep recipes online, and some of them are awesome and they look really cool and they taste amazing. I personally don't have time to meal prep for 6 hours on a Sunday. So for me, I make it super, super simple and basic. So for me, like it's throwing chicken in the crock pot, putting some chicken broth in there, seasoning it, setting it on low for 6 hours. And it's like, boom, there's 5 pounds of chicken breast shredded for the week. Throwing rice in a rice cooker, it takes 3 minutes of work. So I really think it's more just a conversation around like not every meal needs to be like a Michelin star meal you're making for yourself every day. There's easier, faster ways to cook. And so the crock pot to me is a godsend. Like that is the easiest way for me to cook bulk meat really with little work. Instant pot is another really one I encourage my clients. Air fryers, all super easy. You don't have to make it super complex. And I can't remember when you mentioned it, but you mentioned something about changing sauces and stuff like that. And that's what I do. Like I pretty much eat the same general base meals year round. I just change my sauces, my marinades, my spices to keep that changing throughout the week. Now, I tend to be at the end of the spectrum where for me, I can eat the same things every day for a long period of time and don't get tired of it. But I understand not everyone's like that. So it's, you know, go ahead, switch your sauces up. And, you know, what I like to encourage my clients to do is get like a Google spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet, and break down their, you know, calories, break down their macros throughout the meal, stuff like that. And then build a list of meals you really like that are easy to do that you already have the nutritional data there ready for. So when you're sitting there on a Thursday and you're like, I have no idea what I'll cook next week, pull up this list, look at, okay, here's 20 meals I've made in the past. You know, if you pick 5 proteins and 5 carbs and 5 vegetables, it's like, I'm not a math guy. I don't know how many combinations that is, but a lot of combinations you can mix and match. And really it's just about making that cooking easier. You know, this is where like frozen vegetables can be super helpful, right? I'll give a mini rant on that because a lot of times that's a conversation around nutrients and all those different things. And it's like, well, actually, a lot of times frozen vegetables have higher nutrient profiles because they're flash frozen when they're picked versus taking 2 weeks to get to the store. So frozen vegetables can be great. There's, you know, the freezer section can be a dangerous area sometimes as far as what your options are, but there are also really good options in the freezer section. A lot of grocery stores carry frozen chicken breast strips. There's one company I like called Just Bear Chicken. It tastes like Chick-fil-A. It's got really good macros. That takes 2.5 minutes to microwave it or throw it in the oven for 25 minutes. And so it's more just having that conversation around like, okay, how do we just make this an easier process for you? Because yeah, sure, head to head, swinging by Chipotle is going to be faster and easier sometimes than cooking a whole meal. But it's really about how do we meal prep in a faster way to make sure you're ready and have meals on hand that you're ready to throw in the microwave at wherever you are and have that intake.
Yeah, I'm on your same boat of I could eat the same meals over and over again and not get bored. Yeah. My staple is pasta, green beans, and chicken, and I don't even change up the sauces. I love it. But I personally think it is more challenging to eat out than to eat in because there's so many options. Whereas at home, I already have meat thawed out. I already have certain carbs ready to go. I already have vegetables that I've already bought. So I'm very limited in what I can make, and I don't have to make such a big decision because there aren't a lot of decisions that have to be narrowed down. And I also do simplify my meals. My meals take 10 to 15 minutes to make each. So for me, it actually is easier to eat at home than it is to eat out. It's more of an inconvenience to eat out, to decide where I want to eat, what I want to order off that menu. There's so many additional decisions that have to be made. And I've mentioned this, I don't know if I've mentioned this on a podcast episode before, but I've said it to someone recently. I get confused. When do I talk to myself? When am I talking to an actual human? It was, we're all exhausted. All of us. For one reason or another, we're all tired at the end of the day. We all don't want to cook dinner. We all don't want to clean up after ourselves. We're all tired. But that's where it comes of, like, what is the easier choice? And for me, and I think, like, maybe hopefully after listening to this episode, it's for you too, for those listening, that it is eating at home. It is cooking at home. It's having, taking like 1 hour on your Sunday and prepping for the week. And it could just be you're chopping up everything so that you just throw it into a dish and cook it and it's ready. And you don't have to do all this extra prep work, because that does take a lot of work. That is harder. That does take longer. And then there's also more to clean up. So it's really learning the system and learning what system is going to work best for you. I loved your Excel recommendation of recipes. I think that's great, and that's a great takeaway for the audience. But it's really, you don't need to overcomplicate things. And in fact, by eating out, you are overcomplicating things for yourself.
Yeah, it's like that paralysis by analysis. Yeah, that's a really good point. I was thinking about this as you were talking. Unintentionally, I ended up having, or have currently, a bunch of clients that are either first responders. Like, I have a bunch of firefighters and I have a bunch of nurses. Like I said, not intentionally, just kind of turned out that way. And so that's a really common thing, especially with my nurses. Firefighters are a little different because they have time at the house, but with my nurses especially, it's like they work a 12-hour shift in quotes, which half the time turns into 14 hours. And for anybody that's not nursing, it is a hard job a lot of times, and you're running around like crazy doing a million things. And so you're dead tired. And one of the first things I talk to those clients about is, like, we have to be prepared for those days, because that's where your decision-making is going to come into play of, like, well, do I really want to go home and cook? No, I'm just going to get takeout. And so I think that's, like, for me, that's where that conversation comes in. And I just really drive home, and really for all my clients, but especially this population, of, like, we have to be prepared for these circumstances and be realistic and reflective of what our life actually looks like, and be honest about that so we can be prepared for it. Because if you're not prepared, that's when people make the decisions that aren't usually 100% aligned with their goals. Because it's really easy after a day of nursing and you're just, like, destroyed after a day and you're stressed and covered in God knows what, and you're like, all right, I'm just going to pick something up, versus, hey, I have a meal ready for me at home that I like to eat. I like to enjoy all those different things. It's actually the same conversation I have with a lot of my clients that are talking about, you know, if they're going out drinking with friends or whatever that looks like. Have something prepared for you that you like to eat for when you get home, because that choice of the Just Bare chicken nuggets, frozen tenders that are pretty good macros is a way better choice than you going, like, to a local pizza shop at 2 a.m. and getting 3 calzones and going home for the night. So that preparation is such a big component. I try to encourage my people, like, hey, like, let's sit down during our calls of nutrition and, like, you know, what's your schedule look like? How do we prepare this? You know, what days are your busy days at work? Like, I think a lot of people work office jobs. Usually there's, like, oh, well, Tuesdays is meetings all day and I'm running around like crazy, so my lunches, whatever. Okay, well, how do we prepare? Let's, like, walk through your day, and how do we make sure you have enough time and ability to eat? And maybe you don't have a ton of time. So maybe we're grabbing, you know, jerky, a protein shake, and, I don't know, Rice Krispie treats. So, like, we're hitting kind of different food groups there. And so preparation is such a big component of all these different things with nutrition, health, exercise. It covers all of it. It's like you have to be prepared for what life's going to throw at you. And it's kind of a random tip, but going along with that, I jokingly call it my ICE foods, my in case of emergency foods. And I encourage all of my clients to have ICE foods wherever they are. So if you work in an office, bring ICE foods to the office. I have one client who drives all the time for work, so he has a cooler in his car. I have people the same thing. They leave a bag by their door. They're ICE foods. And so it's like, these are your non-perishable food items, which aren't necessarily, like, head-to-head going to be the better choice. But in those circumstances, I'd rather you have your protein sources, your carb sources, your fat sources that are non-perishable, that you can go wherever and always have it. So, like, a lot of times people at work kind of joke with me about that, because, like, I have my drawer of nuts and jerky, and it's like, it's always there. I have my Rice Krispie treats because it's like, I'm going to the gym and I want that before I work out. That's a good choice. So have those ICE foods with you wherever you are. And, you know, that goes back to the preparation conversation of, like, when a client gets on a call and they're like, well, I didn't have any food with me. It's like, all right, we got to address that, because that's going to be the times where you make the decisions that aren't aligned with your goals. And that's where we need to focus. So just a little tip out there, ICE foods, travel it with you wherever you're going for work or whatever your day looks like. Make sure you have it.
Yeah, I always make sure I do that specifically when I'm traveling is I have a food bag because I also, when traveling, will make sure that I buy a meal at the airport because you never know what's going to happen and I don't want to be left hungry. That's the worst thing.
1,000%.
I think with all of the planning and being prepared, the ICE foods, I have a phrase of that I tell my clients of think with your future self in mind. You want future you to be able to thank the current you. And I just traveled for 5 days and me before the trip prepped food for me to have for sleep deprived me to have after the trip.
Yeah.
So that I could
great
eat something and feel good and get myself like ready and kind of adapted into the day because I had a red eye so I needed breakfast ready to go. I knew I wasn't going to want to cook anything. I had a mid-morning snack that I would go to if I still hadn't made it to the grocery store yet. I was gone for 5 days, so I even prepped a meal for me to have for lunch that day because I knew it was just going to be chaos, and I didn't know the timing of everything in that day, and I wanted future me to be prepared for anything, and I thanked myself. I was like, I'm so glad past me did this. Thank you for taking care of me.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's, you know, not even just the traveling on the go. Like another thought I had as we're talking about that is a lot of times I'll encourage my clients, like if you have a day where you don't have much to do for your meal prep day, make a handful of extra meals that you can keep in your freezer at all times, because we've all had that like, okay, I'm traveling for the weekend. I'm going to be home on Sunday and then I'll meal prep. Well, that's when you always run into traffic on the turnpike or your flight gets delayed or something like that. And so having meals ready to go in the freezer are always a good call just to get you through a handful of days. Or even just prepping like a bunch of chicken or a bunch of beef or whatever that looks like, throw it in the freezer because you can always get microwavable bags of rice. You can always get frozen vegetables real quick. And it's like, shit, I don't even have to meal prep today. I just have this stuff ready to go that I can whip out and microwave and be ready to eat. So that's another component of that. And I love the way you said it, like getting your future self thanking your current self. Like, I think that's a really good way to put it too, of like plan ahead. No. And I think it comes back to, and this is a big component of exercise, nutrition, all those things, is like, be reflective and honest with yourself of what that's actually going to look like. Like if you tell yourself you're going to do that on Sunday night after traveling, how many times have you actually done that? And if the answer is never, then don't rely on that. It's going to happen. Like put things in place to prevent this mishap and being like, oh, well, I have nothing for today to go to office with. So yeah, really just focusing on that preparedness component, understanding yourself, understanding how you work and being ready for those variables thrown at you in life.
Yeah. Set yourself up for success in as many ways as you can.
Yep, 1,000%.
All right, so we've covered fitness, we've covered some nutrition, but at the end of the day, it's your brain that is going to make these decisions. And this is where coaching really comes into play because of all of the psychological madness that goes on in your head. And it can be really frustrating to not see results right away or all the time. So what are the best tips that you give to your clients when it comes to being patient and trusting the process?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And when I do my consult calls with people, I really try to emphasize that like this is a long-term project. And if you're not prepared for that, like that's okay. We don't have to work together. I'm not going to be offended. But I really try to be upfront and honest of like this can take a long time to actually combat. And you know, there's different circumstances. Like I've had clients that come to me and like their maintenance metabolism is 4,000 calories a day and they're in great shape. And it's like, yeah, this is okay. We can get you to where you want to be in 8 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever that looks like. But that's a small select group of clients. Most of the time, a lot of my clients were going through the reverse dieting process and buying into that. And so I try to be 110% upfront and honest of like, hey, this may look like 6 months of, you know, increasing your maintenance metabolism, going through this reverse diet. The scale might not move at all. We may have some changes. We may build some muscle, lose some fat, but might not see the scale move at all. And you need to be, you know, mentally prepared for that, but that's going to set us up for success. And this is where I like using different examples from other clients or whatever, just really trying to get them to buy into that. And, you know, as harsh as this can be to say to people, sometimes they need to hear it of like, well, you've tried the other way before and that puts you where you are now. So give it a shot to try something different. And if you hate it, give it 6 months. If you hate it and you think this is a horrible way to do things, no hard feelings. We can cut ties. You can fire me, whatever. I haven't had that actually happen yet because everyone's like seen the results and gone with it, but it is really hard. And so I try to just really emphasize the long-term progression of things and that, hey, this is your entire rest of your life. You know, I know you want to see results in 12 weeks, but what's more important to you? Do you want to see results in 12 weeks? Because we could do that in a really unhealthy way, but then you're going to be in a worse position for the next 40, 50, 60 years of your life. Or do you want to spend a year, 6 months to a year of trusting the process, putting in the work, building that maintenance metabolism, spending time being okay with that to then be set up success for the next 30, 40 years of your life? And, you know, I try to just remind people and encourage people, like, you did not get to where you are now in 30 days. So why do you expect to completely change that in 30 days? You know, it may have been 3 years of eating in a certain pattern and not exercising to get to where you are. So it might take a few years until you actually hit that point. Just really reemphasizing that, like, cyclical yo-yo dieting and, like, look at your past. This is kind of what has happened. So here's how we combat this. Like, here's the science to support that. Here's referrals from my clients if you want to talk to them about how this has worked and how it's worked for them. And just, you know, using those examples and really just, I think expectations are just the biggest component of that. And setting those expectations for a client, like, this might take a long time and it's hard. And, you know, validating their feelings and concerns with, like, it is really hard to do. It's really hard to trust. It's hard to put your hand, like, work into somebody else's hands and just say, go ahead, let's try it. Like, and especially because the way we pitch health as a general population in schools and all those social media, it's very different from what they've usually been told. And so you have to really build that trust and, you know, work with that and set them up for success long term. But it is hard. And so I like to make sure people really know that, you know, it's not easy to do. And so, you know, getting those little wins early on, and especially as a coach, like, reinforcing the positive wins and all those different things are going to be getting people bought into that. And, you know, I've had clients who have told me, like, hey, I didn't really, you know, 100% think this was going to work, but I trusted you. And then I saw it work really well. And so that's cool to see too, of, like, sometimes it takes a little bit of those wins for them to really buy into the process. Then, like, I'm all in, you tell me what you want to do and it'll happen. And so it's hard. It's a long process, but really focusing on that, like, hey, this is the rest of your life we're talking about. You know, 12 weeks does not matter in the grand scheme of things. I have had a consult call where a person was like, yeah, to be honest, I don't really care about the rest of this. I just want to get this done in 12 weeks. And I was like, all right, this probably just isn't going to work out. And I try to walk through it, but it's, like, not at the end of the day. Not everyone's ready to make that change in commitment. So
I want to reiterate one of the things that you said of, it didn't take you 30 days to get to this point. It took months. It took years of all the decisions mm-hmm. you've made, have it compiled onto one another. And here you are on this call, like, not you, but, like, here a potential client is on this call with you. And general population thinks, oh, I can just undo everything in 30 days, in 12 weeks. Like, that's possible. That's realistic. And the way that you explained it just made so much sense. And I really haven't used that with a client. And I've used it in some form of, I had one client of, you've been existing in these behaviors your entire life rather than it slowly progressing you to this point. So, because I think it also depends on when people have these yo-yo journeys, how they go this back and forth of, oh, I looked great, and then I looked bad, and then I looked great, and then I looked bad. And it's like, well, we want you to consistently look and feel great. And that's our goal for you. And I know that's your goal for yourself. So it's going to take some time to get there. It's going to take a lot of unlearning all the habits, all the behaviors, all the mindsets that you currently have that have gotten you to this point and allowing us to lead you to where you want to go.
Yeah. And behavioral change is just, it's a really slow process. And fortunately, there's a lot of good data on this to also support it, but behavioral change just takes time and you're not going to change it all in one night. And the, you know, the rate of people sticking to it, sticking to diets in general is so low because they try to go from this really not necessarily healthy lifestyle and patterns to being perfect day one. And you see, most people can stick it out for 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe they lose a few pounds, but they fall off. And so I really build my entire coaching practice from a nutrition standpoint around, like, I want to make this a lifestyle for you that when we're done working together in a year, 2 years, whatever that looks like, you're good to go. Like, you don't even have to think about making those decisions. And so there's a lot of different strategies on how we actually improve behaviors, and behavioral change is a great science in and of itself. But it's so rewarding for me to work with a client for 6 months to a year and then have them, like, reflect and look back of, like, you were eating 50 grams of protein when we started and it was a struggle to get you to go up to 60 to 70. And now you're eating 150 grams a day and you don't even think about it. Like, it's just emphasizing, like, I want this to be part of your lifestyle. So in 2 years, you don't have to track food. You don't have to think about this constantly. It's just who you are and what you do, and then setting you up for success for the rest of your life based on that.
Yeah. I do the same thing within my business as well. So I've very happy we're on the same page with all these things.
Yeah.
I want to go back to, you had mentioned briefly of someone's not seeing the weight on the scale change. So I personally tell my clients that if stepping on a scale makes them sad or ruins the rest of their day or changes their behaviors, then they need to put it in the closet until we get their habits under control or until we start finding these wins in other parts of their lives. And I encourage circumference measurements and progress pictures, and if they have a favorite pair of jeans, like things of that nature. But I would love to know how you incorporate the scale with your clients and the ways that you can redirect their attention to other important biofeedback markers.
Yeah, and that's a really, really important topic. And there are some circumstances where, hey, we have to use the scale for my clients because I have a lot of weight class athletes. And so my open heavyweight strongman doesn't really matter. There doesn't matter what they weigh in at, right? But some of the clients I do have to, you know, work with that. But a lot of times, if you're not a weight class athlete where we have to check that, and even for them, it's only certain times of the year where we're really dialing that in, we don't really need to use the scale. It can be one of many tools to gather feedback. I think the big thing for me with the scale is that you have two options. You either weigh yourself every day or you don't weigh yourself at all. Because the issue I've run into in the past is when people are like, okay, I'm not going to weigh myself, and then they just hop on the scale one day. I tend to find it most often happens people hop on the scale after a weekend of eating a bunch of Chinese food and they're just really heavy with water weight. And then they're like, well, shit, I'm 5 pounds up and I thought we were making all this great progress. So it's like, this is one of the few circumstances for me where there almost can't be a middle ground. Like, we either need to track it every day so you can see the fluctuations in water weight, or we just don't use it for a substantial period of time, because that's when it happens is like, well, you know, I'm not feeling the best. Let me just see if this whole thing is working out because of whatever they ate the night before. And then they're like, oh my God, this is crazy. So yeah, the scale is definitely not for everyone. And I make that really clear to my people. Like, we do not have to use the scale. If this causes any type of change in your behavior and all the things you cover, perfect way to say it. If it causes any of those things, we don't want to use the scale. We don't need to use the scale. There's a lot better biofeedback tools. I mean, measurements in and of itself is probably a substantially better measurement tool of progress, because, you know, weight can fluctuate so much with water versus muscle mass versus fat, right? But if you're losing inches around your waist, I have seen numerous situations, I'm sure you have too, where the scale doesn't move at all or it goes up, but the inches around their waist are going down. So it's like, that is a much better tool to measure what our progress is with fat loss than the scale in and of itself is, because the scale is going to show weight loss or weight gain. The scale is not going to show fat loss or muscle gain. So measurements are a great tool for that. I like that you mentioned the jeans and how they fit. That's a big one for me, is like, how do your clothes fit? Like, where are they fitting differently? Because that can also be a conversation of like, okay, well, maybe we're building some glute and quad muscles, so maybe those areas are feeling tighter, but the waist is feeling looser. And so that's a really good one. I really like utilizing mood as a tool. You know, how's your mood doing? How's your sleep going? All those different emotional capacities as well as tracking progress. How's your energy levels? How do your workouts feel? How's your strength look in the gym? Those are all really good biofeedback tools that we can track without using the scale at all. So yeah, I guess my big point with that is really just one of the few areas where there isn't really much of a middle ground. Because if you're not going to weigh yourself every day, those numbers can be so junky depending on what you ate the night before. You know, I always remind clients too of like, even if you eat everything the same, if you train legs really hard, you weigh in the next day, you're going to be a few pounds heavier because your body's storing so much more glycogen and inflammation. So the scale is just one tool. And if it messes with your psyche at all, and if you're not a weight class athlete, we do not need to use the scale ever. Like, it's okay. We can do the progress pictures and the other things. So yeah, there's a lot of other things you can look at besides just a number on a scale to, you know, determine progress.
Yeah. I say the scale is your measure on gravity's pull on you. That's it. And yeah, even the scales, because I have a scale that does this. I am guilty of it. I don't really use it often. I hardly step on the scale because I know how it makes me feel. So even the scales that tell you what your body fat percentage is and your skeletal muscle mass and all those things, like those, it's not real numbers. Like, don't be married to those numbers. Of course, you want to see them trending positively if you are using that as a tool. But at the end of the day, the number, the weight that the scale is reflecting back to you is your pull of gravity. And there are so many other important units of measurements to look at and to focus on rather than the pull on gravity.
Yeah, the body fat measurement scales are a really interesting one because I get asked about that a lot. And they are total junk. So I like to put that out there. Like, there's only a couple ways to accurately measure body fat. And it's really using the DEXA scans and the water displacement test. Outside of that, there's nothing that's going to be out. Calipers are okay. Visuals, decent. Measurements are pretty horrible. But the scales are the worst because it's just assessing how fast the electrical pulse moves through your body. And so water can affect that. And so they try to base it off water and body fat and muscle. But I actually did a little bit of an internship at our neuroscience center here. It was a human performance lab. And we were actually testing the electrical impedance for body fat measurement. And so what we did is I laid down, put them on, and then tested it. And then I drank whatever it was. It was like a half gallon of water, just like chugged it. My numbers went up substantially because it was just the amount of water that was conducting the electricity, which then showed an increase in body fat percentage. Obviously, I didn't put on like 6% of body fat in 20 minutes. So yeah, those are junk. Don't look at them for body fat percentage. There's an argument that like, hey, you could look at the trends, but I don't even like doing that because it is so dependent on so many factors. They're not really accurate at all. So for me, I just don't even look at them. If you're going to use a scale, just use the numbers. Don't worry about body fat percentage and lean body mass on there because it's just super inaccurate.
All right. The last question I have for you, and it's how I like to wrap up every guest episode, is what is one final message you want to give to the 20-somethings listening who are wanting to lose some fat or lose some weight and are struggling a little bit?
Okay. This may be a little out in left field. Really, really critically think when you see things online. And this is a big one for me. With the job that I have as a coach, when I'm at my nursing job, I get a ton of questions from people all the time of like, I saw this thing online. What do you think of this? And 98% of the time, it's just horrible advice. And so what I always respond with back to them is, well, what do you think? Like, do you really think that lemon water with cayenne? I use the example all the time on my podcast. So if people are listening, they're probably laughing right now, but it's like, do you really think that that's going to burn body fat? And let's break that down. Like, okay, if they say yes, okay, well, how would that work? Like, if that's true, how would that work at actually burning body fat? And I think it's the same with anything with like exercise and nutrition. It's like, just take a second to step back. And, you know, if something's too good to be true, it probably is. And that couldn't be truer than in the fitness space. And like, really critically think, like, you see these crazy exercise routines people are doing online, jumping around the gym and throwing barbells up in the air. It's like, okay, what do you really think that's doing? And why do you think that? And if you can come up with a good answer, we can have a conversation around it. But like, take that step back. And I don't mean that to sound like condescending in any way. And I think sometimes it comes off like that. But it's just, you know, think through the thought process. Like, you know, I think a lot of people understand like basic physiology to an extent. Obviously, there's levels to it. But like, really think about that. Like, take a second and take a step back. Critically think about where the evidence came from. You know, how valid, can you explain why that would work? And if you can't, and if it's too good to be true, probably isn't. So that's kind of that's a big rant of mine.
Yeah. I don't think it's condescending. I think it makes sense because it's a don't believe everything you read on the internet type of saying.
Yep.
So,
yep. But, absolutely.
Wow. Kyle, thank you. This was so great.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thank you for being a guest on How To 20 Something. If anyone listening has questions or wants to get in contact with you, where can they find you?
Our Instagram for the company is at Milo Coaching Systems. And then my Instagram is at Milo_coach_Kyle. So go ahead, send me a DM whenever. I like helping people out. You don't have to be a paying client to talk to me or answer questions or have questions answered. So send me a message anytime. And thanks so much for having me on. It was a blast.
Yeah. And his information will be linked in the show notes for you guys to easily access, as well as the link to sign up for next Monday's workshop. So don't forget, top 5 confidence killing fears and what to do about them. But if you liked what you heard, or if you learned something new, please let me know or share this episode with a confused friend or on social media, and tag me at coach.justdiamond when you do, tag Kyle when you do. Otherwise, this concludes another episode of How To 20-Something, and I can't wait to be in your headphones again next week with another brand new episode.